Hi, Glenn. How are you?
I'm well, Anna. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. I'm actually filming from home for the first time, but I am usually at the offices of Time Magazine, where I am a columnist and contributor to their blog, Swampland. What do you do, Glenn?
I am a contributor to Salon.com, both to a blog that I maintain there, and also articles that I contribute there periodically.
All right.
So that's our introduction. Do you want to tell a brief little story about how we arrived at the point that we're at?
It's the story that's getting longer and longer the more times we try to set up this conversation. I think it started back, I guess it was even, was it last month even?
Yeah, it probably was at this point.
It was last month. John McCain had a little shindig at his ranch for the press, and you know, lo and behold, who would have thought it, but a bunch of bloggers noticed and had a lot of questions and a lot of thoughts, let's say, about...
You attended, right?
If yes, I attended. Right. I did attend. And actually, as an attendee and as someone who talks a lot about McCain, a lot about the relationship between the media and politicians, and also someone who's very interested in the relationship between traditional journalists and bloggers, I had a feeling that some people were going to, you know... bring me into it no matter what, and I think that I emailed you first because I was like, I know Glenn's going to write about this.
Right, I was just ready to, and right as I was about to, you emailed me, and we sort of started having discussion amongst ourselves and quickly realized and agreed that it would probably be more constructive to have this conversation here on Blogging House or publicly.
But, of course, the sad thing is that we're both not the most technologically literate people, I guess, despite our status as new media superstars. And so now here we are. Hopefully this is working. And while the McCain barbecue, you know, has long since passed, and I think while we could talk about that, there's not much left to wring from it. McCain was in the news more recently, and something that got a lot of attention of a lot of liberal bloggers was this article that you pointed to me, the Neil Gabler article that was an op-ed in the New York Times late last week. Am I right?
Right.
Mm-hmm. And so what did you think of it?
Well, I didn't necessarily find it the most riveting article ever, but I thought it was a good starting point for our discussion because, for a couple reasons. One is it explored the relationship between McCain and the media, which is a topic that I think is going to get a lot more attention, not just among bloggers, where it already is getting a lot of attention, but more broadly. It ought to, at least. But what I thought was so interesting about that op-ed was that it began with this premise that it actually didn't even set about proving. It really just assumed the premise to be true, which was that the establishment press, by and large, is overwhelmingly enamored of John McCain as a person and as a candidate, and that those sentiments unduly color how they cover the McCain campaign, and it sort of just sped by that premise. Really as though everyone just knows that to be true, and then it set out to ask the question why it is that the relationship is so good between the establishment press and McCain. And so...
And I would say...
Do you share that premise that the establishment press is enamored of John McCain in a sort of extraordinary way, and that colors the coverage that he receives?
I think I'm going to choose my words very carefully. I do have a lot to say about the article itself, and I hope we can get to it. I think that Neil Gabler, who, by the way, is actually one of my favorite historians of journalism. He wrote, I don't know if you read his Walter Winchell biography. It's very, very good. Also, he has a history of early Hollywood called, I think, City of Nets, which is fantastic. But I don't think he really gets the current media world absolutely right. And I'm just going to start off by, I think you're right. He does sort of state this premise that he doesn't prove. And a lot of the article I found to state as given things that someone who has written so much about journalism and the media, I would think, would have more care in backing up. One of the fundamental, well, we can talk about the premise, I guess, first, which is, what does the press like McCain? I think that I can't speak for every member of the press. I think that the relationship that John McCain has with the media is extraordinary. And I mean that sort of in all the different ways you can mean extraordinary. It's unusual. One might even say unique. It is hard to find analogs for of any kind. And it does not have the kind of, you know, sort of zero-sum factor that I think a lot of Washington relationships have, with sort of tit-for-tat kind of, you scratch my back, I scratch yours. It's much more like a relationship and not like a contractual sort of, you know, situation.
You mean like a personal relationship?
It's much more like a personal relationship. I don't think that means that that every single reporter covering John McCain has personal warm feelings for him. I don't think that at all. I just think that it is very difficult if you spend a lot of time with someone. I don't care if they're a presidential candidate or your taxi driver or the, you know, person down the hall who you see in the laundry room. If you spend a lot of time with someone, your relationship is going to be different than with someone who you talk to only with other people around in a very guarded fashion in a quick, you know, question-answer format every other day. So,
let me ask you this question. I mean, and you make a good point, I think, that if you spend a lot of time around somebody interacting with them, you're going to have a different perspective of that person, different sentiments towards them, different ways that you deal with them than if you are writing about a figure who's very distant, with whom you have very kind of sporadic interactions. So that's all true. But are there different kinds of interactions that you could have that might affect how you perceive the person? For example, if you interact a lot with John McCain, but sort of at arm's length, asking him questions that are of an adversarial nature, trying to probe his statements for veracity, trying to investigate the claims that he makes to see if they're true, but that's a different kind of interaction than if, for example, you're socializing.
No, I don't think
him,
so.
Laughing with him, spending time at summer parties.
In other words,
you're right about the general principle, but aren't there different kinds of interactions that journalists could or could not spend?
I think that you and I are having a pretty probing discussion. We're really questioning each other. But I like you. I mean, and I would hope that you like me. I mean, I don't think that they're necessarily adversarial and, you know, having, like, basically good feelings about someone are mutually exclusive. I mean, they often are, let's face it. And that's one of the ways that John McCain's relationship with the press is extraordinary. But I've sat in the back of that bus and seen people challenge him a lot, and challenge him in ways that made him uncomfortable, that made people, you know, kind of wonder what he, you know, wonder where this was going. And at times that, you know, where he had to sort of admit defeat on certain answers. I remember Juliet Alperin of the Washington Post. I have another point to make about her in a second. She used to be an environmental reporter, and she really went after McCain on his joke about how the bear DNA study, and mm-hmm. whether or not, you know, it's like we spent millions of dollars on a bear DNA study. I don't know if that was a fraternity issue or a criminal issue. And she actually argued with him persuasively, I think, that, you know, that's a real use for money. And it turns out, I'm sure she had something to do with it. The Washington Post did a front page story on this, on this joke of McCain's and whether or not this was a misuse of funds. And yet,
right.
As far as I know, like, they joked about McCain coming to Juliet's wedding.
Right. Let me ask you this, because, I mean, you had a quote that was in the Washington Post a couple months ago in Howie Kurtz's column, who was writing about the relationship between McCain and the media. And what you said was, it is true that in 2000 the press was so enamored of McCain, so excited and swept up in the whole McCain aura, that the press didn't do its job. And in fact, most journalists who cover McCain are cognizant of that failure and are making the attempt this time around to be more competent, professional, and objective. I mean, what happened in 2000, do you think, that...
We should stipulate that you paraphrased me just now. You didn't quote me.
Right. I mean, I've read you the quote before, and I mean, I think it's a fairly accurate...
I think that's pretty
close to what you said. I mean, what happened in 2000?
It's close, but it's not. I think that the point I was trying to make was about something that I can't speak to in a completely, you know, confident way, because I wasn't there in 2000. But I do think in this cycle there is a self-consciousness on the part of journalists covering McCain. That they don't want to get swept up. They want to be sure. They don't want to be played is actually probably the right way to put it. And I think in 2000, because it was so new, I think journalists were able to sort of relish the excitement of the McCain campaign and cover him pretty uncritically, because there was nothing like it had ever happened before. And there wasn't a narrative in play, and there wasn't a blogosphere to really push it, that journalists, you know, have a thing for McCain. And I just think that people covering McCain right now are much more wary of what their reporting looks like.
Right. You know, one thing that I think is so interesting about that, though, is if you're somebody who writes a fair amount of media criticism like I do, what you generally find is that if you write a piece criticizing the media in some profound, fundamental way, you suggest that there's a profound defect in the way they do their reporting, their instinct is to deny rather vehemently the criticism and to suggest that either you're misguided or you're ignorant about how journalism works. What's interesting here on this issue, namely whether the media is too enamored of John McCain, is that you almost don't even need to do the work to prove that, and I think that's probably why Neil Gabel wrote his op-ed that way, because journalists themselves constantly acknowledge this. And I just want to give a quick couple examples. Like, you know, Chris Matthews says that McCain is speaking to his base, which are reporters. Newsweek said the same thing when McCain had that barbecue. They said McCain hosts his base, and Joe Scarbo recently said that, you know, if every reporter could go to Massachusetts to marry McCain, they would. And I mean, I can give you a lot more examples of reporters admitting, without really even being embarrassed about it or like there's anything wrong with it, that reporters are in love with John McCain and that it shapes their coverage. I mean, do you not agree with them?
You just did this really interesting rhetorical trick. I'm sure you are an awesome lawyer. Because you kind of went from my conceding that McCain has an extraordinary relationship with the press to using the word enamored and also using the word too enamored. And then also you're relying on...
No, I'm saying that's what they're saying. I'm not saying you're saying that.
Glenn, let me finish. Well, then I acknowledge that there's an extraordinary relationship. Then you went on to say that the press is not just enamored but too enamored. I disagree with both of those characterizations. And then the two people that you quoted as examples are two people who have never been on the campaign trail, as far as I know, this cycle.
Well, Ruth Marcus
and who I think
said the
barely
same thing.
Showed up on it.
She has.
Excuse
it,
me? Ruth Marcus, I think she showed up for a day or two. And also, that's speaking of the Neil Gabel article, I think he had six quotes about this so-called, you know, warm relationship between McCain and the press. I think four or five of them predate this cycle. And so there were about 2000. They're quotes that come from the 2000 cycle as evidence, supposedly, that the press is still enamored with McCain. I think if that's still true, then how come he couldn't dig up fresher quotes and quotes from people?
Well,
who
Well, I just all the quotes
the
I gave you are from, you know, the last few weeks.
No, actually, that the base quote McCain has been saying that since 1999. I actually looked that up. It's McCain's own joke.
Yeah, but I mean the media adopts it because there's an.
That also is a joke. I mean, the thing is, like, we also can joke about. I mean, Al Gore jokes about having invented the internet.
Okay, let's talk about that then, because I mean, this is I think, you know, sort of a towering issue that we could probably get some resolution on. I mean, I don't think we're going to agree on whether or not the media and their sentiments for John McCain unduly bias them in favor of McCain, because you're going to say, at least speaking for yourself, that that's not true for you. I can say I disagree, and it's pretty subjective. There's no way to get at that. But what I do think is important is this idea that this is a joke, that, you know, that when Newsweek writes about the barbecue at Sedona and says McCain hosts his base, meaning the media, you're saying, okay, well, that's just a joke. I mean, that's a pretty dangerous joke. And probably a pretty inappropriate one. I mean, don't you think there's a substantial concern on the part of the establishment press that they not be perceived as being in the tank for John McCain? I mean, you know...
Well, I was actually going
to
say...
I mean, is that really an appropriate thing to be joking about? And isn't that going to erode the credibility, if there is any, that the establishment press has in the eyes of lots of people?
Hey, Glenn, I am probably the last person you'd ever want to talk about whether or not a joke is appropriate. I have my own feelings about that, and I also feel like in general, you have to go pretty far afield to find a joke that's truly inappropriate. And I think when you're making a joke in an article that was clearly lighthearted, that's not something that's perhaps part of a trickle in the avalanche of reasons that people don't trust the press, but I'm not going to give a lot of weight to that. And I'm also going to point out that Newsweek just this past week ran a very critical article of McCain that talked about his temper.
The one by Michael Hirsch.
Right.
I actually wrote about that article. today. Actually, it referred to him on multiple occasions as a centrist, as being a moderate and a centrist. Do you think that McCain is a centrist?
I don't, actually. I think that is fundamentally incorrect.
Yeah, that was sort of the centerpiece of the article, was that he's this pragmatist who now and then, you know, gets very zealous when he feels like he's right, but that's probably something Americans want in a leader. I mean, I think
he is a pragmatist, but that doesn't mean he's not conservative.
Right. If that's the article, that's sort of the template for, you know,
no, it's not the template. This is the thing. There is no template, okay? We live in an era where there is so much, you know, so many choices and so many outlets for where one can get their media, you know, fix. I feel like it would be inappropriate for me to presume to tell you or to tell anyone, like, what the template for a John McCain article would be.
No, that up as proof that the establishment...
No, they ran a critical article. You've used the word template, and I just said they also ran a critical article. I'm just saying that, like, one article... Well, actually, you know what? I have an idea. This is something I was thinking about. Rather than argue, sort of in this, you know, somewhat, like you were saying, like, incredibly tenacious. I was going to say that, you know, we're arguing about something we're never going to agree about.
Right.
You know, I was actually joking with my husband that you and I could have, like, the shortest blogging heads ever, where I would say, I think the media can be friends with people that they cover and still be objective. And you would say, I don't think they can. And then we would end
right.
Let's move forward, because actually I think what, you know, I always hadn't been thinking about it this way, but your point that a lot of people in the media are willing to concede, if not, you know, affection for McCain, then respect or even admiration, you know, in some cases, then that surprises you because you're used to, you know, people being more, the mainstream media being more guarded. I think that is an opportunity to move on beyond, like, arguing whether or not the press is close to McCain and then looking at their coverage.
Okay, well,
like,
so
let's stop having the fight about,
so let's do
know,
that then, because actually...
What the relationship is,
right,
and just move on to what the coverage
what
is.
What I was actually suggesting was that the reality of whether, you know, the press is too enamored of McCain to cover him properly is never something we're going to agree on, but the perception... among a lot of people, that if the reporters go and have slumber parties at his ranch over the weekend, that's likely to affect their coverage negatively. Whether that perception is accurate or not, I think journalists ought to be concerned about whether they're creating a perception that they're being unduly biased in McCain's favor.
And here, I guess, I never thought of myself as old-fashioned in this way, but I think journalists should be concerned about whether or not their stories are correct. I think this idea that I, as a journalist, or that anyone as a journalist, should be concerned about this perception. I mean, if you choose to be concerned about that, that is a perfectly admirable thing. I mean, I think, or it's a choice that I understand, even if I don't agree. You know, the New York Times didn't go to the Gridiron Dinner this year, which is a big social affair where, you know, journalists hang out with figures from politics, and they're also not going to go to the White House Correspondents Association this year, which you're probably more familiar with. And so the New York Times has made a decision, at least institutionally, to not go to these very public events that are sort of supposed to be off the record and where there's fraternization between journalists and the people that they cover.
Right.
You know what? Fine. That's fantastic. Does that make you trust the New York Times anymore?
Yeah, I mean, I think it does. So
really?
If you're the reporter that Time Magazine, you know, the largest news weekly in the country, has assigned to cover the presidential campaign once there's a Democratic nominee. And during the week, you know, you go around to all the events and you cover the debates and you write articles on the candidates. And then during the weekend, every weekend, you go to the McCain ranch and you, you know, hang out with the McCain family and you have barbecues. You're saying that that's not something that a reader of Time Magazine would legitimately be interested in and think is affecting your coverage?
First of all, Lynn, if anyone's going to that ranch every weekend, I would like to know about it. I think you're exaggerating for effect, which is fine. But the truth is...
No, the point is you can't segregate them that way. I mean, you have a professional obligation to cover the campaign, and obviously if you have too much of a social interaction with the candidate, that's going to affect in a negative way your ability to do your job.
We're having that same fight again, because you're arguing about perception. We're having that same fight again, because you are arguing solely about perception.
Right.
And I'm saying... I don't care.
Okay, so let's move on
to
the specific episode, the recent episode agreed that we were going to talk about, which is McCain was traveling in the Middle East with his close political ally, Joe Lieberman. And
Lindsay.
Oh, what's that?
And Lindsey Graham. Lindsey,
his other close political ally, Lindsey Graham. And on several occasions, in a speech that he gave, once on the Hugh Hewitt show, and in a press conference that he gave in Israel, he accused the Iranian government of training al-Qaeda elements inside of Iran and then sending them back to Iraq. And he did that on several occasions. The fourth time that he did it, in this press conference, when Lieberman and Graham were standing behind him, Joe Lieberman whispered in his ear that he didn't actually mean to say that, that Iran is not training al-Qaeda, but instead they're training Shiite extremists.
And we know for sure that's what Lieberman said to him, by the way?
Yeah, you could actually hear it audibly on the tape. Right. He said, you don't mean Iran is training al-Qaeda, you said al-Qaeda, right. He meant Shiite extremists. And without there being barely a second elapsing, McCain immediately recited what Lieberman had whispered in his ear, which is, oh, I didn't mean that Iran was training al-Qaeda elements, I meant Shiite extremists. And that night, the McCain campaign issued a statement saying that McCain had misspoken, that he didn't mean that Iran was training al-Qaeda elements, because they're not. He meant that they're training Shiite extremists and sending them back into Iraq. Most of the press coverage about that incident was... the theme of it was that McCain had simply made a gaffe, or that he had simply misspoken, as though it was just kind of a disconnect between his brain and his mouth, where he meant to say one thing and other words came out, as happens to all of us. In fact, this was something that McCain was deliberately saying multiple times over the course of an entire week, at least four times that people have found already, which I think suggests only two possibilities. Number one is that he's just completely ignorant about the most basic facts in the Middle East, and specifically the relationship between Iraq and Iran, Shiites and Sunni. Or, I think much more likely, because trying to depict Iran as a grave threat is one of the centerpieces of his campaign, and the need to stay in Iraq is due in large part to check Iran, he was actually engaged in the kind of deceit that we've been subjected to over the last many years, where the Bush administration just exaggerates and lies about whatever the newest enemy is and declares them to be in some way in concert with al-Qaeda, whether or not they in fact are. I mean, that's what McCain, I think, was clearly doing. And yet, if you go and look at the press coverage, you would be extremely hard-pressed to find it being reported that way. And this is when, you know, the last point here is, this is when, you know, I referenced Ruth Marcus earlier, John Alter made the same point, a lot of people went on the Sunday shows that weekend and made this point, which is, if either Hillary Clinton or Barack Obama had made a similar statement, it would be a huge controversy for several days at least. But because it was McCain who did it, said all of these reporters, they were giving him a pass because in their mind he has so much credibility in the bank, as a foreign policy expert, that he's entitled to not have his judgment questioned when he does something like that. That was a pretty vivid example to me of extremely skewed coverage, whether it's because they love McCain or other reasons. What do you think about that?
Well, your last point about the Sunday shows reminds me of something that has always bothered me about the discussion of the press's relationship with McCain, and as you pointed out, the press's admission of that, you know, being a unique relationship, which is that I think reporters like talking about that and like referencing it and like using it to explain things because it makes reporters part of the story. And I think on the Sunday shows that happens a lot, because it's in general. One thing I learned about being on TV, that this is not a great secret or anything, but if you want to sound smart as a pundit on TV, you want to say things like, well, I was talking to the Hillary campaign, and they said, or, you know, when I was talking to John McCain, and he said, I mean, you want to advertise your proximity to these people as much as possible, even if it means that you're on a conference call, or if you're with, you know, 1,000 other people in the same room. And I think that, you know, I don't know Ruth Marcus. I know Jonathan Alter. He's a terrific guy. But I think that there is a tendency to want to use your own resume or use your own experience to bulk up whatever point you're going to make. And I think that it's can be kind of lazy. And I think that the explanation for why reporters, how those reporters explained away the coverage of McCain's gaffe. Like, I don't want to get to the gaffe just yet. That how the way they explained away that gaffe, to me, doesn't necessarily ring true.
What does ring true?
Well, about the coverage of the gaffe, I think that the point that he was trying to deliberately deceive people is one that I actually hadn't heard before. I guess I haven't been keeping up with your site enough. That is a fascinating idea. And I wonder, I was sort of thinking to myself when you were talking about it, I wonder if the McCain people would prefer that to the narrative that he's senile. Would they rather have him be deceitful or senile?
Yeah, I mean, you know, one thing that's interesting, one thing that's interesting about that is, and I think they would prefer almost anything to, you know, having it be perceived that that happened because of his age and the effect that it's having on his cognitive abilities. But, you know, one thing that I think is so important to keep in mind is that the person who's standing behind McCain and whispering in his ear and leading him around Israel is Joe Lieberman, who has on numerous occasions in the past explicitly advocated a U.S. military strike against Iran. As has other McCain supporters like Bill Kristol and John Bolton. And so, you know, the idea, and McCain, yeah, McCain, I mean, McCain hasn't quite gone that far, but he certainly vowed that if Iran is close to acquiring the knowledge for developing a nuclear weapon, in essence, that we would attack in order to stop that. So this animosity towards Iran is such a vital part of the McCain campaign, and it also is a part of the case that he makes about why we can't leave Iraq, which is if we leave Iraq, Iran is going to exert even more influence than they already are. And so exaggerating the Iranian threat, and there's really only one way at this point to convince Americans to perceive a country as a threat which is to tie them to Al-Qaeda.
Right. I think that you're very eloquent explaining your theory. I also think that if I could just sort of bracket that to make a point that, trust me, is related. One thing that I've thought about a lot in this cycle, having had my first real close-up experience interacting with campaigns and seeing them on a day-to-day basis, is how little of what happens in a campaign is planned. And I think this is especially true of the McCain campaign, because for a long time there just wasn't really a campaign. There was just the candidate and like five other people. That things that can seem like they were brilliant masterstrokes of strategy turn out to be simple, strokes of good luck. I was talking to someone at the Hillary campaign about an article that came out that lauded their relationship with Matt Drudge, and I can't remember the example they used, and he was telling me the backstory of that example is that, they just lucked out. Like, that no one tried to, time it perfectly so that it would be the same time that Barack Obama was giving foreign policy address. That's just sort of when it happened.
Right.
And I put that out there because I think that while I find your theory enticing and definitely worth investigation, I think that it is also completely plausible that there's kind of a less sinister version of that as an explanation, which is that McCain does believe that Iran is a huge threat. And he probably believes that they are in some way, I'm sure you read it, it's very speculative, but there are people that say that there's some kind of nebulous, third degree connection there. And
right, but McCain repudiated that. Lieberman said, no, that's not something that you want to be asserting, and McCain said, okay, that's not true.
It could be that that's something that, perhaps he shouldn't have been saying in public. But I'm just saying that it's easier, knowing that campaign and knowing how campaigns work, it is much easier for me to believe in him having made the same mistake four times than it is in having him make a concerted effort to subliminally convince the American people that Iran is involved in Al-Qaeda.
And I think that's reasonable. But I think that, nonetheless, that underscores what a big story this was, because either it's what I'm suggesting it might have been, though by no means saying for sure, which is that it was a reflective of a will to deceive, or it's what you're saying, which is that McCain just got the facts wrong Not about some obscure topic, but about the topic that is the centerpiece of his campaign.
No, I didn't say that he got the facts wrong.
And that really undermines what his principal political asset, which is the idea that he's some sort of expert in the Middle East. And
I didn't say that he got the facts wrong. I said, you're right. I mean, I am saying that he got the facts wrong, but I'm saying that I think it's something a little bit different than being ignorant of the facts. It's the way that sometimes, you know, my husband, if he's really, you know, wishes he was watching the Cubs, he'll say Cubs instead of Nationals when he talks about the baseball game, you know? Like, he's not consciously trying to convince me that the Cubs are playing. He's wishing they were playing there. And that's in a way, like, just as weird a thing to be the answer to that solution. But I just think that I'm just cautioning against the argument that there's like a specific deceitful plan here.
I sort of presented that you're actually advocating the most benevolent possible interpretation.
Well, I'm just saying
does your husband or anybody else that you know misspeak in exactly the same way on multiple occasions?
Actually, you know what? You know who does?
That's a pretty bizarre neurological
condition. You know who does? Mitt Romney used to screw up the same facts every time he said them in his stump speech, because he was giving a stump speech, because he was like not thinking about what he was saying. And again, that's a knock on McCain if he's not paying attention, you know. But I would be willing to bet that when he said those things all wrong each time, that the things on either side of them were wrong as well. But you know what? I want to stop talking about like why, because we don't. Actually, I think I want to say that as we paused for a minute there, it started to occur to me how deeply embarrassed I am for my profession that we just spent 20 minutes talking about, you know, this thing, this hiccup of some kind that McCain had. I mean, he also gave like a very important and, you know, thought out policy speech on foreign policy last week as well. I mean, agree or disagree with it. I mean, I would hope that speech probably said more about his position on foreign policy than this series of either errors or deceptions that he made. Although if they're deceptions, that would say a lot about his character. I think another problem or I guess sort of point of concern for me in talking about this is how quickly, and you're right, sort of fascinating, how quickly the narrative on McCain's, you know, confusion of those of Iran and or of Al-Qaeda and extremists, how quickly that story morphed from McCain makes a mistake of some kind to the media's being soft on McCain. Did you see that? I sort of, looking back, I kind of feel like that's what happened, that there was very little coverage of the error itself, but it just sort of immediately became about whether or not the media was doing their job. Even within the media, as you point out, people on the Sunday shows, you know, talking about the way the media treats John McCain. And that just sort of gets back to the idea that the media like to be part of the story.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I think what happened was this happened in the middle of the week, and virtually nobody talked about it, at least in, you know, any way.
And then when they talked about it, it was...
And then on Sunday, the question was, well, I mean, and it wasn't like it led any of the Sunday shows. I mean, it was buried in the middle.
Right.
And the question was, you know, why wasn't this a big deal? Because it wasn't. It was ignored almost entirely. And even on the Sunday shows, it was presented as, oh, McCain had this little momentary lapse. Why wasn't that a big deal? And it was almost completely...
And that allowed them to talk about the press, instead of, which I think actually is something that you and I can't agree on, is no matter what the motivation was or unless it was him being, you know, befuddled, which I don't think that was it. Why he made that mistake is actually an interesting question and should have been perhaps talked about more.
Right, and he should have been challenged on it. You know, I mean, they said, oh, he misspoke. Clearly, whatever it wasn't misspeaking. I mean, it was either he was confused, he was ignorant, or he was deceitful. It was one of those three.
I think that there's another option that's sort of between confused and deceitful. But I can't say for sure which it is.
At least it should be up to the voters to decide that, right? I mean, the media should say, here's what happened. He said the same thing four times on the most critical issue in his campaign. He linked Iran to Al-Qaeda, which is what Bush did with Iraq before he wanted to invade, and what McCain's most hawkish supporters have done. here's someone to say that it's deceitful. Here's someone to say that it shows McCain doesn't know what he's talking about in foreign affairs. Here's somebody to say, no, this is no big deal. It was just a slip of the tongue four straight times in exactly the same way, and let the voter decide. That just didn't happen. The media decided that it wasn't a big deal because, of course, we all know that McCain is an expert on foreign affairs. Of course, we all know that he's an honorable person who doesn't lie. And therefore, you know, it's something to sort of show the video of because it's weird video with Lieberman whispering in his ear, and then we just kind of move on and don't
investigate what happened. You're really jumping to a lot of, I mean, listening to you recite this, I mean, you have a whole narrative there that doesn't take into account a lot of, like, the, you know, more fluid aspects of modern media that have to do, yeah, you know what, whatever play that got, I'm sure it got partially because there was video. Because, as you know, cable news networks need a clip. You know, they can't just have people talking. They need a clip of some kind that shows something. Usually it's, you know, a lost, you know, female or, you know, fires or floods.
Right.
But
they
also
had clips,
like,
of all the times that he said it, though. I mean, they could have played those clips.
I mean, I'm just saying that, like, I think this gets back to my sort of feeling that I do not think that there was a people sitting around saying to each other, you know, I have a choice today of covering, you know, Hillary misspeaking about Bosnia or John McCain misspeaking about Iraq. But because I know that John McCain's a good guy and I like him, I'm going to do Hillary.
What caused them to reach that conclusion?
I would be shocked if someone... Excuse me?
What is it, then, that causes them to reach that conclusion over and over and over that, instead of talking about McCain's embarrassing moment, I mean, instead focus on, you know, whether or not Hillary's showing...
I guess I don't
whether
believe...
whether she has a wicked laugh or whether she lied about Bosnia. I mean, if it's not what is it, then?
I don't believe... I don't know what it is. Again, like, I mean, I do feel like some... Maybe we should stop having this little talk, Glenn, because I feel like I'm a really imperfect representative of my profession because the way that I approach it and the way that I sort of came to do what I do is so different than most people who practice it. And like I said, I have trouble imagining the situation that is described. Maybe I just don't know enough journalists, but I really have trouble imagining it. And I think it has to do with, you know, what's a good story that day? There's also a feeling, I mean, it could be as simple as the fact that, you know, McCain is in the shadows right now. Like, you know how hard, it is to get a seat on the Obama or Hillary campaign versus the McCain campaign right now? All that's sexy in the world is happening on the Democratic side. I mean, I'm just saying that there's lots of reasons why decisions get made in the media.
Right.
I'm accountable for the decisions that I make, and actually this is a good segue, I think, to how bloggers are influencing the election, because I can tell you that over the past month, like, I have had this real crisis in approaching my job and have had to think about whether or not I want to talk about, you know, any given subject at all, because do I want to deal with the headache that will come if bloggers decide to gang up on me? Mm-hmm. And
is that a good thing or a bad thing that you're thinking about that?
I can't tell you. I think my writing has suffered. I think that...
I mean, maybe it's become more self-critical. I mean, with the process that you're describing...
No, you don't know me very... Again, you don't know me very well, Glenn.
I'm just asking. I'm not stating. You're right. I keep hacking you. I'm asking you.
I'm pretty self-critical. I'm pretty self-critical. And my rule of thumb has always been... I mean, I'm not a stranger to people being critical of me online. And I'm sure, you know, anyone who writes online, as I'm sure you do, have people that make it their, you know, point of existence to find errors and flaws in your thinking. It just seems to me like the volume has really increased. And also it has to do with the fact that I am writing about slightly more serious things than I used to. But I feel like... I mean, this is about as close to dream interpretation as we're going to get, because I'm going to talk about my feelings. It seems like if one were to think that what I bring, if you think I bring any value at all to the discussions that we're having and to the you know, online discussion the dialogue that is blog posts and comments, if one were to think that I bring any value at all to that, it would be that a certain, let's say, a reverence and appreciation for absurdity and sort of willingness to say the thing that might upset people. And, you know, it's harder and harder to kind of, or at least just, again, this over the past month, and it could be, there could be a lot of different reasons for this going on in the back of my head, but I'm not sure if it's healthy to be, because you know what, because I'm not concerned about being wrong. I'm concerned about people not listening to what I have to say.
Right. Well, I you know, I think it's interesting.
And that was a long, and hey, blogging heads person, you can cut out a lot of the wishy-washiness there, but do you know what I mean, though, that I feel like I have a pretty good track record on whether or not I get things correct or incorrect. And if I get them incorrect, I feel like I correct things pretty quickly. But the conversation, this is going to sound odd, but sometimes I feel like the conversation, at least for those of us that blog on sort of mainstream media blog, which there still aren't that many of, it's not, what I thought would be good about it is that it would be a conversation with readers and a conversation with other bloggers. But it's really there's very little listening.
Right. Well, you know, let me say this. I understand fully what you're saying. I empathize with it because there's virtually nothing that I write on any topic that doesn't provoke, you know, extremely ugly and vicious, you know, attacks. And I know they're inevitable, and I couldn't be any more indifferent to them. I mean, the last thing that I'm going to do is start avoiding topics because I think it's going to unleash this tidal wave of ugliness. I mean, it's just part of what it is that we do. And that's why, although I'm empathetic to what it is you're saying, I'm actually very unsympathetic. And I'll tell you why that is. I know you're not looking for sympathy, but beyond...
And also, I'm not... I think I want you to understand what I'm saying. I'm not saying that I'm avoiding certain topics because I'm afraid of the ugliness. I think that I'm not afraid of ugliness. What has frustrated me in the recent past is when I've gone on the comment boards and exchanged and tried to, like, argue my case in a more informal way than just a post.
Right.
To feel like there was... that the people I was talking to, you know, had their hands over their ears and were just saying, no.
Right. Okay, let me make and this...
That,
let me, I understand.
And so I'm
I
not...
Understand.
Please,
you're
so please don't say... I don't want you to be sympathetic
to me. You're saying it's not constructive. It's not that it's ugly.
Yeah.
It's not that it's nasty. You feel like...
No, I didn't say... Did I use the word ugly? Did I use
no,
the word
I
ugly?
Did. I'm saying you're okay. Not saying it's not too right. Nasty or too ugly. You're saying it's not constructive, that it's not a conversation. There's
yeah,
people aren't listening.
That's what I'm
okay,
saying.
I get that. But, and you're right. I mean, clearly there's a lot of, you know, exchanges on the internet, and also in political discussion generally, that's about everything except, you know, two sides exchanging ideas in an open-minded way. And so, I mean, I don't think anybody would dispute that. But what I do think is so important to note is that for a long time, you know, it was on the exact opposite extreme. I mean, you know, you're somebody who writes for a large publication. You know, the things that you write can have a significant effect. And so for a long time, people who were in your position really weren't getting any feedback at all. I mean, it was a one-way conversation. You know, there'd be a letter to the editor at most. But by and large, people like you in your position wouldn't hear any feedback. And that was, you know, a very suffocating dynamic because it just engenders this kind of uncritical, one-sided way of thinking. And, you know, one of the things I've told you before, and I'll say it again because it's relevant to what we're discussing, is that one of the things I think that you've done that is worthy of the most credit, that's really quite commendable, is you've really brought this interactive model to Swampland and to Time generally, where people who aren't accustomed to dealing with their readers in any direct way, who have been just working in journalism a long, long time without that feedback, are now getting that feedback. And as a result of them getting that feedback, they're now thinking about some of the criticisms that are valid that they've never heard before because they haven't been exposed to that sort of thing. And you're right. Part of it is very, you know, sort of hostile and antagonistic in a way that isn't constructive. Part of it is just venting, you know, people angry justifiably and unjustifiably in some ways at the political process, the media, and you're a target for that, and so, you know, you're getting a lot of hostility spewed towards you that's not about a constructive dialogue. But between the two extremes, you know, journalists like you who have a great platform and an influential position, being able to opine and report without hearing any feedback of any kind other than from your colleague, and having to hear too much, meaning some nasty stuff that really isn't constructive, I think clearly the model that we have now is infinitely preferable. And I think what's important for you to do is what's important for everybody to do, which is to listen to the criticisms that are substantive and worthwhile and to ignore the ones that are just about spewing hatred, which we all are the target of, and it's just incumbent upon us to you know, be to have discretion about what we think is important to listen to and what isn't.
Thank you for telling me what's important for me to do, Glenn.
No, I'm just saying. I mean, I think if you're that bothered by this, then I think the solution. I mean, I don't know what else the solution is. I mean,
I wasn't asking you for a solution, actually. But I appreciate your input. I think we've both been doing this for a while. And when I talk to my colleagues about this phenomenon, I say the exact same thing that you do. And I actually was one of the people that pushed for open comments on Swampland, have them be not moderated. I would never go back. I would never have them be moderated. I am also someone who's been an advocate for interacting in the threads as well as doing updates on posts. In fact, at a journalist roundtable where some very prominent people from certain national newspapers in my metro area were speaking about how they'd suffered through, you know, these flame wars in comments threads, I said something much like you said, which is that, you know, I didn't get in, you know, you don't get into journalism for praise. You don't get into this to be liked. And also, the alternative, in any situation where you're saying that this feedback is hostile, all of the alternatives, all of the way to fix that on the comment side are unacceptable.
Right.
Right? And so I totally agree with you. And I would never want to go back. But I think also, and I hope that this is something that will change as just more and more people come to participate in the dialogue between the mainstream media and the readers and the bloggers and the many people who are involved in that, in sort of making our narrative happen and critiquing it. As more people become involved, I hope that we continue to have the, let's say, adversarial relationship that exists now, but that it be also conversational. And that just sort of brings us full circle to what I think the ideal relationship, you know, with a source is, and within that, you know, what I think journalists would like to think they have with McCain. I'm not sure if all journalists, you know, are living up to this, or maybe they don't want it. But the idea that you can have a very adversarial relationship and you can disagree pretty extremely on issues, but that when you talk to each other, it is in a way that is respectful and in a way that has the possibility of either changing a mind or learning something. And that's what I'm sort of regretting doesn't exist right now. Like I said, I hope that the medium matures to a place, or that we become more skilled, like in interacting with each other, that it comes about.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, I think both extremes need to be avoided. I mean, I think excess, you know, contempt pretty much precludes a meaningful dialogue, even if the contempt is justifiable. Just like I think excess friendliness and socializing precludes the kind of arm's length relationship that you need to have a constructive relationship as well. And I mean, I think, like you said earlier, this session that we've just had is a pretty good model, where we've obviously disagreed, often vehemently, but I think, you know, talked about these topics in a constructive way without, you know, sort of the personal attacks and kind of expressions of pure hostility that might have gotten in the way. And I think that is a good model. You know, if you and I had really vicious exchanges in the past of a personal nature, or if you and I, you know, regularly socialized with one another at bars and parties in each other's homes, I wonder whether this sort of dialogue would be possible.
I think my husband would be able to tell you that I can be plenty adversarial with people that I love very dearly. I mean, I just, this is, we're so back to where we started.
Well, because, you said full circle, and that's what we've done.
Yeah, because I believe that you can be, I mean, I think, I'm not saying that being close to someone doesn't change anything. I'm just saying that I think that people, it's impossible to report as though you were a robot and just like didn't have opinions about somebody.
Last question on this, because Hunter Thompson, in his famous 1973 Rolling Stone article on the campaign trail, said that one of the problems that happens if you're too friendly with political figures or anybody is that if you discover things that they've done that could subject them to real jeopardy, I mean like criminal prosecution or going to jail the way that politicians have, if they're really your friend and you really feel friendly towards them, you're going to be reluctant to, quote, turn them in, even though that's what a reporter ought to do. Do you disagree with that? Do you think that when you're really friendly with someone and socializing with them,
sure,
you'd be more reluctant
to
turn them in if you discover wrongdoing on their part?
Glenn, if I found out that you had robbed a bank, I would be sort of sad to have to turn you in.
Uh-huh. But how about something if I had done something minor? Like if I had not been forthcoming
cheated on
my
a test
taxes,
in college?
Or if I had, if I had been Elliot Spitzer, something that you consider to be less significant than robbing
Spitzer's
a bank. Are you going to turn me in? Or if we're hanging out every day, are you going to be less likely to turn me in under those circumstances?
I think I was trying to make a distinction between regretting doing it and doing it. I think it's possible that, and it would be human to regret doing it. But I think that it would be, that doesn't mean you're not going to.
Right.
I think there are plenty of times in my life that I've had to hurt someone that I care about because they've, I wouldn't say plenty of times, I don't hang out with hardened criminals or anything, but I'm sure everyone has a point in their life where someone who they care about, or not even just care about, not even, just someone who they know and like, to put it even more generally, has done something that disappoints them. And you have to make decisions, and that's one of the ways that life is complicated, is to make decisions about what level does that disappointment lead you to action. And I think that, it's not easy to answer that question in any case. Like, you can give me all sorts of hypotheticals, but I would be very reluctant to answer them because all situations are different, and it's also really presumptive to know, I would have to know without, I feel like to send anyone to jail,
Well, we're talking
about
just a reporter writing an expose. That's what we're really talking about. And
well, if you're a reporter writing an expose and you have your facts down hard cold, I guess for me, the question is what kind of, what is the crime? It's and every reporter probably has sort of a different level of what meets. It's not just, think about it. Also, it's not just whether or not you're friends with somebody that makes, that is a factor. It's also just whether or not this is a news, this is something we had our last discussion, it's whether or not the thing that you're reporting on is newsworthy and relevant.
Clearly. But it assumes it's newsworthy. And for me, I think it's just best for people that you're writing about and covering just to leave out those kind of complex formula by not making them your friends, by keeping them at an arm's length.
I think
be respectful with them,
and
have civil interaction, but,
not
go to their house for a weekend and have barbecue.
You
keep
on saying that people went to this house for the weekend, by the way, and I just want to correct for the state of, for the sake of facts,
right,
that no one spent the night there.
It was on the weekend.
It was on the weekend, right. But no one spent the night at his
room. All right, well, we've definitely come full circle, and we're at the 20-minute mark, too, unless you have other points to add. I think this has been a pretty complete discussion and interesting.
Except maybe sometime we should talk about something that's been an off-and-on obsession of mine, which is I really wish that I could take, the top 20 both liberal and conservative bloggers and give them a journalism fellowship and have them go out and be reporters. Just because I think that there's a lot of things that are complicated about the job that people don't that are hard to explain and hard to see.
Yeah.
Unless
I think the premise there is that people who criticize journalists who aren't journalists are misguided because they don't understand the complex profession.
No, I didn't say.
I don't really.
I really am not meaning they're misguided. I said my fondest wish is I wish they could do it. I think it would not necessarily change their opinion of journalists or change their opinion of how
it might worsen
the world
it, right?
Over.
I mean,
it might worsen it.
I found that when I've interacted more with journalists, sometimes it actually bolsters the criticisms that I've made.
But I would feel more confident that, this is something we talked about last time. I guess I would feel more. I would hope that, that their views of the process become more nuanced. And by that, again, I don't mean more positive.
Right.
But there's a lot of complexities here and a lot of decisions that get made on a day-to-day basis and a moment-to-moment basis.
All right.
That
I think a lot of media criticism is nuanced. But, all right, well, again, I think we're out of time.